Thank you for joining us on our journey here to preserve the history of mixed martial arts. When I wanted to take on this project, I needed help. I brought in one of my favorite matchmakers, Miguel Iturralde, and the MMA detective, Mike Davis. So to do this, we've been able to preserve history. Welcome and enjoy.
Lights Out Podcast, Miguel Iturralde here. Mike Davis there. He's the MMA detective, and that means that we are off on another deep dive. Chris Lytle, waiting in the wings. We got a returning victim here, cause someone coming back for number two, Mike Gerald Harris.
Yeah, sometimes Miguel, when you do an interrogation, you got to make sure you know that they're getting their story straight. You know, like you got to make sure that everything is ironing out. In essence, what we're doing is whenever we have somebody that we really like, you know, as podcast hosts, we have a bad. Well, first off, everybody that's given us a portion of their career, whether it's the UFC years or pre-UFC years, we will do a reroute and get to them again. And Gerald Harris was so easy. He opened up time for us that we've been sitting on this one for a while. And this is us talking about the second half of his career, UFC, beyond UFC. It's going to be interesting. And he's a fun guy. He's a fun listen. So it's just, it's one of those things where it's more for us. And we hope that you listen. And on a side note, betdsi.eu, 50% of deposits are equaled up to $1,000. Bet on sports, guys. Use the promo code Lights Out. It really helps us out a lot. February 5th, I am in Tampa, Florida. Register on Smooth Comp if you are a jiu-jitsu player and it's world-class grappling. Please come out, say hello. Those are my plugs, Miguel.
Cool. And here we go. Gerald Harris. There's another Gerald Harris podcast out there that you can look up.
If this pre-UFC.
Is the first one that you're catching, that's the early part of his career. And like Mike said, you know, he may not be the most famous guy. And, you know, he's kind of got one of those, like, you know, John Smith names too. But don't sleep on this guy. It's one of the most entertaining interviews in this one.
Fun guy. 100%.
Nothing less than the first one. So thank you, absolutely, guys. And without further ado, Gerald Harris.
Okay, back again with Gerald Harris. We couldn't get enough last time. Really had us intrigued, and we got cut short. So, I mean, we were just getting to where he got, you know, where he's really starting to make it for himself. And, you know, we have to get more. So, Gerald, how you doing again, man? Thanks for joining us.
I'm good. I'm always eating with you guys.
I know.
Hey, I'm snacking now. I'm good.
Mike thinks you're going to weigh like 300 pounds soon. I said, not a chance.
No, it's all good.
No, Gerald, thanks for joining us. And like Chris said, in terms of couldn't get enough, we taken up like 2 hours of your time already, and we had just gotten to some of the meaty stuff, and I could tell that we were going to go longer. I think this is the best way. This way we broke it up and stuff, and that way, you know, we get to sink our teeth again into this. So, Mike, where are we and what do we got? Gerald Harris, okay. Awesome stuff.
So Gerald makes it to the UFC after losing on The Ultimate Fighter. He's told by Joe Silva that if you can't make it on The Ultimate Fighter, you can't make it into the UFC. Ever. Gerald then goes on an 8-fight win streak and prank calls Dana White and goes around the system, around Joe Silva, the gatekeeper, and finds his way into a match with John Salter. Now, John Salter is another southpaw. He's a state champion wrestler out of Alabama. And it's a hard first fight.
Two-time NCAA champion, too.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Stud wrestler.
That's a big difference. I mean, I'm no disrespect to Alabama, but I'm not sure the wrestling's nearly as good as Oklahoma River, so that wouldn't mean much. But then you get a two-time NCAA, that's a big deal.
Yeah. So, Gerald, obviously, you had a fight. So I think you had an original opponent that fell off. John Salter. Mike Massenzio falls off. Salter fills in. Obviously, he's in good shape. You're 13-2 at the time. Salter's 4-0. And your first round, you were pretty conservative on your attacks. You landed a heavy right hook at the end of the first round that broke Salter's nose, and it was ugly. It was a horrible break. Can we agree on everything so far?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. My coach said I was going to do it, and it happened. So, well, I'll say this before we move further. And Chris, you can co-sign that. As my career went on, there wasn't a lot of video. So, I mean, when I fought Salter, all I had was a couple articles. I had no video. I didn't know how good stand-up was. I knew he was a good wrestler, but I had to be a little tentative in the beginning because, I mean, in those days, you could get a DVD of somebody. The UFC would send you videos. I'm fighting a guy that I'm like, he's a good wrestler. I have no idea what's coming. I didn't know if he was Southpaw Orthodox. I didn't know anything till we touched gloves. So, yeah, wow. It was a little slow start. But, I mean, a lot of people don't understand in almost every sport, you watch video. You watch film of your opponent or your coach does. And I went in there with this guy who I knew was a great wrestler, but I didn't know if he was a hell of a kickboxer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So now, it was a little awkward.
Did you have some kind of a funny feeling like this dude is 4-0 and he, how do you even make it here against me? What's going on? Did he have to go through all the hoops? Did he have to call Dana and prank him? I mean, what were you thinking? What the hell's going on here? How this guy making you?
I knew he was a purple belt in jiu-jitsu and a 2-time NCAA, I think, Division II champion. Regardless, that's just his resume was pretty good. He came from a good camp, and that was back in the day when if you take opportunity, you know, you get in. And he took it. You know, he probably tried out for the Ultimate Fighter or something and didn't make it. And you know what I mean? And it was like, oh, we'll take that guy. And it happens. A lot of guys try out for the Ultimate Fighter, don't make it, and they're still on the waiting list.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't know what to expect, you know.
Well, in the second round, you open up a little bit more. And in essence, you become more aggressive. And Salter's nose is starting to, like, just pour at this point. Like, it's horribly broken. Like it's like disfigured type broken.
It was bad. It was bleeding. I mean, that was a game plan. When we saw him at Wayne's, coach said he got a big ass nose. He was like, break it. He's like, you're going to break his nose. And I was like, all right. I think it was a jab that did it. That got him.
Really?
Good. Yeah. I'm told you I'm a right-handed southpaw. So my jab was hard.
Yeah. He's a converted southpaw.
Yeah, the game plan was I knew he was going to be in good shape. It was just basic sprawling brawl, you know, and then I was going to get the takedown when needed. But, yeah, it was a good fight.
So how did you end the fight?
I took him down. The game plan was to keep him on his feet for 2 rounds. He never expected a takedown. I threw a fake lunging hook to a double leg, and it just worked perfect. Had him in half guard, just ground and pounded him out. So It was just something he wasn't used to. A guy that's 4-0 probably fought 4 guys that can't wrestle. And
exactly.
He ran into me. I was, you know, I wasn't All-American in college, but I was really good. So my MMA wrestling was on point, and I was very confident at that time. I was boxing with pro boxers and, you know, still wrestling at the high school and some college guys. So it was a great game plan going into the fight. It wasn't the most exciting fight, but, I got the finish. It was the only finish of the night.
Nice. You so said
knockout of the night.
Nice. Only one, yeah. It was the knockout of the night. It wasn't. That was it. The only knockout of the night.
You said he was out of a good camp. Whose camp? What was he out of?
I don't remember, but I know he's with Derek Brunson now. So he probably was still with them out of North Carolina, something like that. But I remember talking to Joe that night, and I was like, I get the knockout bonus? He was like kind of pissed off. I was like, yeah, you're the only knockout of the night. I was like, I'll fucking take it. I don't, I mean, hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll ask for it. I'll ask for
a lot of decisions.
So that was the next little bit of the path I was going to. We talked a little bit about how you got on, which is a great story with the British accent, and how you went right to Dana. And you already knew that Joe was like lukewarm on you. He didn't really like you. And now, you know, the boss put you in, but you won fight of the night. You know, you won the
knockout.
You performed, you won, and everything like that. He didn't give you a break at all. He didn't say, all right, you know, you come aboard. He was a dick to you the whole time, or what?
He's okay. When I spoke to him, he was always cordial.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. I think that, I don't know if it was an ego thing, but he did not, it almost felt like he didn't want me to succeed because I was in a lose-lose situation. And there's not a fighter in the history of the UFC that's went through what I went through. And in a sense of, I know every fighter isn't someone that you build up, but what I was doing to people, I should have been fighting different guys. No offense to those guys, but I mean,
big
I was fighting newcomers. Well, and I'm a nerd. And if you get super bored, if you go to my UFC resume and you look at every guy that I knocked out, Every guy I knocked out fought nothing but UFC veterans after that. I'm talking about Damian Maya, all kind of names like Joe Lawazan. I mean, not Joe Lawazan, I'm sorry. The guy, David Loazao, the one from Canada. I mean, they were just fighting big name guys, and I'm sitting there going, yo, like, you know, it was just weird. You know, I understand how a guy I knocked out gets a higher profile fight than me. So I knew, I didn't have any idea what was coming, but I knew that I had to win. And it didn't matter how I won, because what a lot of people don't understand is, I mean, not only just like getting yourself out to the fans, but when you're fighting a new guy, it doesn't matter what I do to him. You just can't lose to him.
Yeah, that's right.
If I knock him out, he's a UFC rookie. If he beats me, I wasn't ready for the UFC. You know, I never fought a UFC veteran in the UFC. Or
even if you beat him and you don't beat him impressively, then you still suck. You're not that good.
And no matter how good he is. And think about this. Like, you beat a Damian Maya, it's somebody that's established where the fans go, oh, wow. Everybody that he beats, and we'll get to his resume, you've got to wait for them to establish themselves before it becomes impressive. It's not impressive because, you know, they don't have like a UFC track record, which brings us to your second fight, UFC Fight Night against Mario Miranda, March 13, 2010. Mario Miranda comes in at 11-0, and he's a South American wrestling champion. Joe at this time is obviously 14-2. And, you know, you kept using your counter right hand to catch him. You started this a lot faster than you did against Salter in this bout.
I feel like the longer the Mario Miranda fight, the worse it would have went. He was 6'5", 11-0. Confidence was out of this world. He was like a Muay Thai champion, a wrestling champion. I was like, the only way I'm going to beat this guy is I got to knock him out, period. So I went after him. I was throwing a kitchen sink at this dude. That's probably one of my best and most entertaining fights. But here's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. And I'm going to be super honest. When I don't know who's fighting, it's okay to watch, but I really don't care. I love college football and the NBA and the NFL because I know the guys that's on the field. I know of them. I'm like, oh, that's that dude that played at Clemson. Oh, that's that guy. But when you're fighting some dude that's 4-0 from Alabama, nobody really cares. You know what I'm saying? So it's like Mario Miranda, I was like, I got to get this dude out of here. I got to get him out of here. It was a great, if you watch the finish, it was nasty. I caught him with a hook. I started throwing haymakers, finished him off. But imagine if that was if that was Chris Leben or Damian Maya, you know, I would have been all over the news, but it was Mario Miranda. Nobody gave a damn about him.
Yeah, exactly that you were talking about was, he went on and beat David Loazo after that, you know, and Loazo was already a pretty good established name. Why didn't you get that fight? You know, it's definitely a question.
I was wondering the same thing. And then he fought Damian Maya after that. And then he fought like Ruzman Paul Harez. I mean, those guys got the great fights, like literally. So it's weird, man. Well, I mean, I know why, but I'm just saying that I was never put in a position to progress.
Do you feel like, I mean, they were trying to get you beat? They might have thought that guy was going to beat you. I mean, he's 6'5". He's got a lot of accolades. You feel like they were trying to get you beat?
No, it was exactly what Joe said. It was you don't. I'm going to show people that you don't belong in the UFC because at some point you're going to lose to somebody. You know what I mean? That's not high profile. Now, if Joe gave me Damian Maya my second fight, and I'm not cocky at all. I was ready for Damian Maya. I wanted to fight Damian Maya so bad.
Yeah.
Almost the same way that, Kobe Covington beat him. Just, you know, great shot defense and beat up on him. And I knew it. That was a great match for me. Anyway.
Yeah.
To prove a guy that he's not ready by not ever giving him a chance to prove he's ready. I never had a chance.
Well,
not once.
Do you feel like real quick, this is mainly due to the fact that you bypassed him and just went straight to Dana? Do you think that's one of the reasons why
100%.
He had a bad taste in his mouth from the whole time?
It's 100% because I had plenty of time. I had a lot of fights. I fought January, March, July, and in November. But it was just – and then I would have fought 5 times that year, but my opponent pulled out like 2 days before. I still got paid. I was in – when Randy Couture fought James Toney. I was on that card. I made weight. I told Joe Silva, I said, Joe, I know I'm not fighting. And I think Damian Maia was on that card. I sat there and watched Damian Maia fight Mario Miranda, and they got booed the whole card, the whole fight. But I weighed in. I tried to weigh in. I made weight. I even had to scale out and everything just in case somebody didn't make weight. I was backstage 185 pounds on the dot.
Wow.
So let me add a little caveat to the story. So Miguel and Chris, we talk about just geniuses behind the scenes that just meticulously put together a game plan. And it's anybody coming from that camp, you really got to be careful. And the reoccurring name that we come up with is Matt Hume. So Mario Miranda was not only 11-0 with a decent wrestling background, he's walking out with Matt Hume. And he had been with Matt Hume for about a decade.
Matt Hume was really impressed with my win because I had an amazing game plan for Mario Miranda. Every time Mario Miranda threw his lead leg kick, he dropped his left hand. And if you ever watch that fight, my coach said, when he do it again, get him. And that's what he says. And my coach is, and Chris, I can't hear nothing but my coach.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly what he was talking about. And every time Mario Miranda threw a lead leg kick, he dropped that hand. And I check hooked the hell out of him. I mean, it was, I couldn't ask for a better punch. I mean, I look like Super Mario Brothers. I mean, I look like Mike Tyson punch out. Little dude to jump up.
Ding.
The point, yeah, and it just landed perfect. But I'm telling you, I don't believe in luck in fights. I think that if you train it and it happens, I mean, it's all about circumstance and situations. And when I tell you that punch landed perfect. I mean, right on the chin. You know, it was a pretty neutral fight, and it was good. It was fun. I'm glad it was over. I'll tell you that.
So from that bout, he goes and fights UFC 116 against David Branch. So David Branch is 6-0 with six finishes, and he's being referred to as the Henzo Gracie prodigy.
Black belt out of Henzo Gracie. His comes from a professional boxing background. Both of his brothers were professional boxers. I did have video on him. I scraped up some video, but it was him just mauling people. It was punch, punch, double leg, beat down. And I said, okay, he has a good double leg. And that's all I have in that video. So we drew a double leg defense. Another one where we had a hell of a game plan. That game plan for him was the same as John Salter, just sprawl and brawl. And I didn't know. I knew that I could outpoint him. I did not know I was going to slam him to death, though. I mean, he tried a flying triangle, Chris. That's what he tried to do. He tried to do a flying triangle.
I seen it. I was there for that one. I was fighting that.
He was
night
on that card. So. Yeah. We was on that card together.
You took my bonus.
Yeah, we talked about that. My bad. Hey.
I didn't get a knockout, man. I got a submission. So.
Brock Lesnar took your bonus.
I know. Exactly. Somebody took it. Yeah, you made me go for a submission instead. Yeah, I go, I ain't winning the knockout.
here's another case of what you talk about, Gerald. You know, David Branch, especially when you look at what he did with the World Series of Fighting years later, you know, that should be a win you're getting a lot of credit for now. You know what I mean? But at the time that you got it, it was too early.
If I would have got these guys after they beat those names, then it would have been different. You know,
yep.
Joe Silverman would have been like, you know, David Branch is coming off a win over Ruzman Paul Horace and Damian Maia. But no, it was like, oh, this guy's 6-0 on a local circuit. Looks good. Oh, shit, he got knocked out. I mean, it's a losing situation. And what's crazy about it is, you know, we'll get to the fight where I lost and got cut. You know, the guys that I beat got chances. You know, I never got that chance. So
he's 3-0, and he's got knockout of the night, two knockout of the night bonuses. So out of his three fights, you got bonuses on all three of them?
Yeah.
That makes it worse.
Oh, my God.
So he
had the second fight when I knocked out, so, and Chris, you know about this one. When I knocked out Mario Miranda, it was bad. But the same night, Roy Nelson knocked out the tall guy.
Stephen Struve.
And I talked to Joe, and Joe goes, hey, man, both of y'all got knocked out of the night, but he's got a bigger name. And I said, I understand that. He's like, look in the mail, and I got a check in the mail.
Nice.
Oh, that's well, all right. Showed you
a little bit. So he wasn't sure, but got you a check anyway.
I mean, you're not going to get me knockout night publicly over Roy Nelson. You know what I'm saying? Roy Nelson had a nasty knockout, though. It was mad. I mean, you knock out a 6'12" dude.
He folded him up.
Folded him, bro. Like.
So they never publicly announced it, but privately they gave you a check.
Yeah.
That's wild. So three fights, three bonuses.
I think Joe really liked that knockout. I mean, he never really said much to me, but he was like, good job. He always dapped you up after the fight.
Yeah.
And even after the slam, when I slammed David Branch, he gave me a little dap. He was like, good job, but nothing after that.
I gotta call them out here on this, man. You know, I think it's another spot. It's like, all right, so Roy Nelson knocked out a 6'10" guy. Lead with that. But what are you doing with a private bonus? Why not publicity your way, though? No, anybody's way.
It was common back in those days. I won't complain about that because they didn't have to give me anything.
That's true. That's true.
It was kind of like it was a motivation, you know what I'm saying? So
all right.
I wouldn't complain about that one. But then he basically said, even if I knocked out Stefan Struve, the fact that it was Roy Nelson, I mean, you just had to. That's what sucked about the bonuses back in the day is the guys with the names normally got them. You know, yeah.
You fought a card with one of the Diaz brothers too. I bet he got it that night.
And I got into it with Errol Hawani. I'm jumping ahead a little bit. When I knocked out David Branch, that knockout was good. I didn't even get invited to the MMA Awards. And I'll jump even further ahead of that. You guys know about the viral knockout from Legacy. When the guy came in overweight, and I got into it with Errol Hawani. I said, Errol Hawani, this is the second time in my career that I slammed somebody to death. I mean, I've slammed people, but this one went viral, millions of views. And this is what he told me. He goes, oh, that was a great knockout, but it wasn't significant enough. And I go, and Landon, whatever, got it for a spinning back kick. I'm like, dude, people hit spinning back kicks often. And the significance is what I learned is they're looking at these names and it does look more impressive, you know, when someone with a name knocks. It's not fair to the little guys, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, do you get the feeling that Joe Silva, that somebody said, hey, go give Gerald a check. They didn't want to do it.
No, they was cool about it. I remember the guy that used to give us checks. I don't know if he's the one that drug tests us, but he was really cool about it. He was really cool when I met him backstage and he would cut me my check. They cut you the check backstage, Chris.
Hey, he's probably on his best behavior after he had to call me and take that thing away, man. He's probably still scared.
Chris,
why don't you get into the story about how you got a bonus check taken from you?
What?
Haven't I already told that?
No, not here. No.
Oh, bro. So I fight, what was UFC 119, I believe, in Indianapolis, you know, so I fight Matt Serra. We put on a hell of a fight, you know, and I won a decision. And afterwards, you know, I'm excited. I'm walking back and I'm walking through the, you know, the hallways and the guy came, hey, Chris, I got something for you. So handed me an envelope. I opened it, you know, $70,000 bonus. I said, yes. I said, oh, thank you. I went home, put it in my dresser drawer there, told the wife, hey, we also got the bonus. Everybody's happy. I wake up the next day, you know, I'm walking around and all of a sudden my phone rings and I look, it's like 702 number, like Vegas. Huh? I answer and he's like, Chris, I don't know how to tell you this, man, but I thought you won the fight of the night and it wasn't you, man. So I'm going to need them back. And I just sat there for about 5 seconds and here's what I said. I go, hey, man, I already cashed it. And he goes, Chris, it's Sunday. I just started laughing. I was like, I said, all right, man. What do you want me to do? He said, I'll just cancel the check. I said, all right, whatever, man.
You should have said, with he a didn't give it to me.
They should have gave it to you, man.
That's what I said. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? So that's two that I think they owe me, man. The one where Brock Lesnar squeezed the guy's head and got it, and the one where they gave it to him. And here's a bit of the thing. They gave it to my buddy Matt Mitrione. When he fought, he fought the executioner. They gave it to him for that fight. Like, that's weak. Yeah, I was like, "Come on, man, give it to both of us. You made the mistake. You guys got the money. You can't take it away. So they
when the guys with the money get the bonuses, I'm like, come on, man. You don't
it doesn't need make that, any bro. Sense, man.
You got a quarter mil in that fight. I got 10 grand.
Like, exactly. Not happy. But I mean, money, you know,
changed my life.
It sucked, man, to have that check in hand. I was like, man, you don't take it back. That's on you guys. I take it out of his check. I don't know, but whatever.
So Gerald, at this point, was Joe Silva contacting you direct or was he going through your manager?
No, I had a horrible manager. I'll tell you about that in a second. My original manager was a really close friend of mine. Went to jail on child support. And while he was in jail, I had to find a manager. And I signed with this guy. Rashad Evans hooked me up with him. And no offense to Rashad. We're still good friends, but that guy was terrible. His name was Jahani Curl. And I can legally say his name because he stole a lot of money from me and a whole bunch of people at Greg Jackson's gym. I remember one fight, I probably got 20 grand in sponsors and he gave me like 2 grand. I mean, he was he was signing checks. I mean, that guy's dirty.
Did he get caught for it?
I don't know where he's at. I know they ran him out of New Mexico. He can say public defamation, whatever you want to call this, but it's a God honest truth. We even got the bank statements approved that he was stealing hella money from me. So, yeah, I mean, I'd get a $10,000 sponsorship. He'd tell me it was 2 grand. He'd take the 8 and give me 2 minus 20%. I mean, it was anyway, dude was a
he
snake.
He'd killer you.
I've never publicly said that, but it's about time, Hill. You know, so anyway.
Wait.
Yeah, he just called me. He'd say, hey, you got to fight. This is who you're fighting.
Wait, and Gerald, so, hold up. Did you catch this guy or did other people catch him?
No, I won't say who did it. Somebody sat down with me and showed me the bank statements where I fought on a pay-per-view card. And I got a $10,000 sponsorship and he gave me like $1,500 out of it. So he was basically signing the checks from the companies like Muscle Farm and all those big names and getting paid for it. And I remember one time I was like, yo, this is 3 grand. I owe you 20% of that, which is, you know, whatever it is divided by 5. He's like, nah, man, you're good. Go ahead and keep it. I'm like, well, shit, I didn't know he stole 7 out of it. I mean,
yeah,
he was just a snake. So
Did you ever find him after that happened? Did you ever see him again after you found him?
Once I got cut from the UFC, he disappeared. I mean, he didn't want to be around. But
did you have to pay taxes on that 10 grand?
No, because I don't know. Yeah, you know what's funny? The dude had the nerve to send me a W-2 or some shit. Like I worked for him. And technically he worked for me because I paid him. He never paid me. I signed all my checks. He sent me a W-2 for the money. I mean, he probably had my social and everything. I mean, that dude's a snake, man. So he sent me a W-2. And I'm like, yo, I didn't get this. But this ain't the money I made. And I never even touched it. IRS never contacted me either.
We're going to have to talk to Rashad about this.
I ain't going to mess with Rashad.
What was your part, Rashad? How much did you get kicked back?
Gerald, yeah, man. As the show grows, we plan on like doing more with our guests. So what I think we're going to eventually plan, because we like you, dude. You're one of us, man. You're one of our guys. We'll have you and Chris go to this guy's house, and we'll just do an in-person interview, like on his front lawn.
Yeah, right. Now, he got chased out of – he was at Greg Jackson's, kind of taking all the up-and-coming guys. And once he got caught stealing money, they ran him out of there. But that was kind of on top of all the crap that happened after my fourth fight in the UFC, which was the guy that was 23-2 with 21. It was stupid. His record.
Here we go.
Insane.
Let me set the table for you. So UFC 123, November 20th, 2010. They give you Miguel Falco. It's his debut. You're 17-2 at the time. You're 9-0 since the Ultimate Fighter. He's 25-3 with 21 KOs, and he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's also yoked to the gills, and it's not an easy fight.
He was on all kinds of steroids.
he was good. Another one. He was on all the steroids.
Imagine fighting somebody. Imagine fighting somebody with 21 knockouts and no video. There was an extremely grainy video on YouTube of him. Joey Beltran beat him at like heavyweight. it was an ugly fight. You know, Joey obviously outgassed him. But there was nothing on there. Then he posted his video of him training, which was really good. But I was like, okay, he's really explosive. But he was ripped. I mean, he was ridiculously ripped. And I don't have nothing against people blame me. People claim I'm on steroids. I'm like, please, dude. Not even close. But I could just tell. And any athlete knows when someone's not natural. And for someone to go from heavyweight to be a shredded 85-pounder for him, I'm like, he had to be doing something. I mean, something ain't right. Anyway, long story short, he knocks me out in the first round. A lot of people don't know this story. And I didn't know it till after the fight. I watched the video. I thought he headbutt me. So I think John McCarthy was the referee. And I'm on my feet. And the next thing I know, John, I'm blackout. And as I wake up, John McCarthy's looking at my face like this.
No way.
And I'm like, oh, shit.
That's not good.
I'm out.
Yeah.
So I wake up, I'm in a fog, and I'm naturally doing jiu-jitsu when I'm knocked out. The round ends, he chokes me out or something, and I'm still out of it. I do remember fighting the choke until the bell went brr, and if you ever watch the video, he's on my back, and I'm just holding just like this, which we're safe. You can't choke me out here. It goes brr, I let go. And for 3 seconds, bro, he goes, shh. And Chris, you know it don't take long. And I go out a little bit, and I'm looking at the referee. I'm like, hey, I'm like trying to argue. I'm like, hey, choke me. He's like, it's all right. You know, he's literally right. Pulling this dude off me like a pit bull.
So this is what happens. So Gerald, it's 11 seconds left. Falco gets Gerald's back, sinks in a rear naked. It looks tight. Like you're saying it's not. It looks tight. The bell rings. Falco refuses to let go, and Murgliata literally had to get in and pull Falco off. And Falco's like, "Yeah, I didn't hear it." I mean, it was as plain as day. He was just trying to choke Gerald unconscious.
And Chris, this is after nobody can last 11 seconds with a chokehold. 2-3 seconds, you tapping on your sleep.
Exactly.
I'm holding on. I had great grappling partners. My hands in there. I got my hand. I'm cool. He's squeezing his butt off. I'm like, I'm fine. But my mistake was when that bell blew, I had one hand on the mat and I put both hands on the mat, and he cranks it, and I'm like, and that was it. So I don't even remember the second round at all. I don't remember it. I was still in a daze from getting knocked out, getting choked out, and then halfway through the third round, I kind of wake up, and I really thought I was winning the fight. I was like, ooh, this fight is. I feel good. Like I'm throwing hands. I'm moving around. I'm like, wow. I'm whooping this dude ass for 3 rounds. What round is it, coach? He's like, it's over. I'm like, shit, how we do? He's like, bro, you lost. I was like, what happened? He's like, you got whooped. I was like, really?
Really? Like,
I didn't remember.
Say who, me?
Yeah.
Bro. I didn't remember a damn thing. I thought I kicked that dude's ass, man. I was like, that third round, I started bouncing on my toes. I was like, let's get it.
So the second round, Falco gets Gerald's back, and Gerald roughs it out. Like, he roughs it out. Third round, Falco's up 2 rounds. He knows he's up 2 rounds. And like somebody that might be a little lazy, he runs the entire third round and doesn't throw a single punch for the first 3 minutes while Gerald's chasing him. Refuses to throw a punch, refuses to engage, because he's like, I've already got this fight won. I am not fighting this round.
10-8 round.
He said he broke his hand. There was zero evidence of him breaking his hand. I think he's the one to coast out of fight. Not sure if it's a cardio thing or not, but I'll say this. And someone from that organization called me about a week after I got cut. And they were like, look, man, I ain't supposed to tell you this, but the dude you fought failed a drug test horribly. Maybe he stands and all, something like that. Not a week after, a little bit out. It was about maybe a month after. He said, it's horrible what happened to you, but I got to tell you this. The guy that beat you failed the drug test, 100%. Not only did he fail the drug test, Chris, he didn't have human pee. He tried to. I remember going backstage. I peed in a jar. He had his trainer with him. I said, "Hey man, he don't need a translator to pee. You know, there's no language for pissing. You piss in a cup." And his trainer standing over there talking, and I'm arguing with him. I'm in a stall, and I'm all beat up and shit. I'm like, "Hey man, he don't need no trainer to pee. And they was like, shut up. We arguing backstage. Like, I'm, you know, peeing in a cup, arguing with this dude. Like, why is he here? Why is this trainer here?
Yeah.
And they're like, don't worry about him. Come to find out, he tried to use non-human pee. They made him pee twice. The first time he peed, it wasn't human pee, probably horse piss. The second time he peed, he failed for stands and all something else. Now, if you want to double check that story, it was him. I don't remember his teammate's name. He had another teammate, kind of built guy at 205. He fell for the same drug. Same drug that Falco fell on. It was stands and all. Some super steroid.
During the third round, you see Joe Silva, like, kind of like he's on a mission. You know, he's standing up, he's pacing, he's going back and forth. I really like watching fights like this because I kind of look at the audience and just like the ring circle. And Silva was gonna make a point. Like, finally, he had his moment.
Well, so, they were booing, and I mean, he was running, man. He was running bad, you know.
So when do you find out you get cut because of that fight?
So here's what happened. That was actually on the pay-per-view card. That's what happened. That was a problem. So I was the first fight on the pay-per-view card. And what was cool about that, other than the ass whooping I took, BJ Penn knocked out Matt Hughes right after me.
Oh, one punch.
Boop, little short punch, knocked him out flat cold. So that's probably pretty cool after such a boring fight to have such an exciting turnaround. And it was the first fight. I worked my way from fight nights to actually being on a pay-per-view card, man. I was the first fight. Rampage fought Machida that night. So first fight on pay-per-view, got booed. It was bad showing. And I got cut that Tuesday. I'm at the post office with a tub of mail, Chris. I used to do fan mail every week, and I got a tub. I'm talking about those big tubs, you know what I mean? Where you put a bunch of crap, and I'm Japan, Brazil, America. I'm sending mail. I responded to I'm signing everything. I'm sending it out. And I go outside. I got my tub. Joe calls. I'm like, ooh, I got another fight. And I'll never forget it, man. Joe goes, hey, man, I'm sorry, but we got to let you go. I'm like, let me what? And my heart sank, man. It was like, I almost went to like, I can't even think. I almost fainted. You know, it was so unbelievable. I got lightheaded and I kind of sat down. I was like, oh man, I said, Mr. Silva. I said, what did I do? What do you mean? I'm done. He goes, I said, why? He goes, you're just boring, man. You're not entertaining enough. I said, but wow. I got three knockouts. And then I didn't know about that last fight. I hadn't watched it yet. I said, I had one bad fight and three knockouts. He said, I'm sorry, man. It just wasn't entertaining enough. And I was like, can I ever get back in? He's like, no, that was your only chance. And then he hung up.
He hung up?
He said, he's like, you're boring, man. He's like, your fights is boring.
You know what I would do? I called my manager and said, I just got prank called by some guy pretending to be Joe Silva. I need you to call Dana. Don't call Joe.
I called my manager. My manager had no – and Dana kind of was in on it because – after the fight, Dana's like, yeah, that fight was terrible. I'm not sure if we'll have him back. And people was like, what? Like, the dude's 3-0, three knockouts. What?
Okay, so when I said Joe Silva's like on a mission, what he's doing is he's getting up and talking to Dana. And then he walks over here and he goes back. Because
Dana doesn't like to be proved wrong. So yeah. It's like, I made Dana look bad. Hey, that's your guy. I put him on a pay-per-view card. He stunk it up. So, I mean... Here's the thing is, it was really messed up. I still, to this day, I've never recovered from it mentally. To be so, I mean, I don't think people, it's almost like being in the NFL, fumbling at the end zone and getting kicked out of the NFL. I mean, you go from making all that money, and I had the biggest house in the neighborhood. I was taking care of all my family. I was the NFL player of my family at that time. I was doing really good financially. And I went back to working for $11 an hour, literally within... and fighting for a couple grand. I mean, my next fight, I end up losing. We'll talk about that in a minute, but it was very depressing, like very depressing to go from a pay-per-view card to a local fight and losing that local fight and having a regular job. I mean, I was training full-time. I was loving life. Oh, I wake up, I run 4 miles. I take my kids to school. I eat lunch. I roll at noon. I eat. I get some rest. I was online gaming all day, and I trained 3 times a day. And then I went from that to working from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. You know, and training in the evenings every once in a while. It just changes everything. I just don't believe that something that you work so hard to get should be taken away so easy.
Man, now I had a fight, you know, right? Was on the Ultimate Fighter, lost it, you know, all the money, all the title fight, all that stuff. And you know, the winner got a couple hundred thousand dollars, loser got virtually nothing. So I don't think people could understand the amount of what that does to you mentally, like you're saying. And that about broke me for a long time. You know what I mean? But luckily that was right around the time they started doing the bonuses. I was like, man, you owe your kids a lot of money. Do you a couple grand, 100,000? You got to go do it somehow. Luckily, I was able to win some bonuses, change the way I fought to do that. But I mean, they just took it from you. Didn't even say you can't even get back, man. That's I don't even know what to say. I don't understand. I don't understand it.
And I know people with all kind of motivational sayings. I have never ever recovered from that. And even to this day, it was 11 years ago, people coming to me at the mall and they're like, hey man, what happened to you in the UFC? How'd you get cut? I'm like, bro, really? Like, I do not want to talk about this shit right now. I've never gotten over it. I don't care what people say. I understand why. I understand how shady it was. But what they said was in the interview, they said, hey, we're just trying to let fighters know that if you put on a bad fight, we're not afraid to cut you. But here's the counter to that. It was contradicting. Because if I was British, I'd have been a superstar, you know? Imagine if I was from England, you know, if I was a British guy. What's that one guy's name that got the easy title shot? Fought GSP. What was his name with the mohawk? I can't stand him.
Dan Hardy.
Yes. Imagine if Dan Hardy did what I did in three fights. If Dan Hardy...
It'd be a household name.
If Dan Hardy knocked out Mario Miranda. If Dan Hardy slammed David Branch to death.
Yeah.
You know, he wouldn't be fighting Malkiel Falco on freaking pay-per-view. You know, and the Falco fight, another one where I had to be a little tentative, no video. Malkiel Falco had all three of my fights on DVD sent to him. That's back in the DVD days.
Yeah.
They sent Falco, and it wasn't shady. That was part of the practice. If you fought somebody from the UFC, you could ask for their videos. And back then, the UFC would send it to you on DVDs. Nobody I fought had a fight for me to watch.
Yeah.
So Falco had an amazing game plan against me where I didn't have one. My game plan was, oh, this dude's a black belt and he can box. I got to knock him out. Oh, this guy's 6'5". I'm going off, not even video, you know? I watched Mario Miranda's kickboxing video and I was like, okay, he drops his left hand. But I didn't have three UFC fights to study. They had three full fights of mine to study for that camp. They were ready for me.
Well, let's talk about relationships.
You know, it's
okay. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, you know, it's so weird how, you know, they decide, like you're talking about, if one guy does it, it's this. And if somebody else does it, totally different reaction. I mean, exactly. Your story is about as bad as anybody I've ever heard of. I can only think of one of the guys from my gym at the time, Jake O'Brien. His record was 4-3 in the UFC. His three losses were to John Jones, Andre Arlovsky, and Cain Velasquez. Cut him.
Yeah.
He had four wins, three losses, and those were the three losses, and they cut him?
Here's my thing. There's no criteria. No, there's no criteria. I saw a guy that was 0-5 and got a 6th fight.
Yeah.
There's no criteria. None. Because here's the thing. If I would have got a DUI, I'd have got cut. If I'd have punched the old man at the bar, I'd have got cut. If I threw a dolly through the bus window, not only would I got cut, I'd have got charges pressed against me from the UFC. So, yeah, I wasn't Conor McGregor, and I definitely wasn't John Jones. So there's no such thing as if you do this, you get cut. I mean, those guys have 9 lives, maybe 12. So it just depends on your value. I mean, it's almost like this is what it feels like. They're a billion-dollar company. I'm not talking bad about them, but there should be some kind of criteria. You can't validate something when it doesn't apply to everyone.
I mean, I understand a little bit more about, like, okay, if people bring in more money, I get that. But all that being said, that's a totally different thing. But to me, you're 3-1. You're knocking out three people, getting three bonuses. There's no way in the world you. I mean, there's other guys like you're saying who are 0-3, 0-4. How are they getting more opportunities?
You lose. Can I give examples?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so well, here let's start with like a recent example. Sam Alvey. Sam Alvey is 0-6-1 in his last 7 UFC fights, and you know he's got about 15 bouts, but he's 0-6-1. And he's got Ian Heinrich coming up in like 2 months.
This is what it is. It's a high school mentality. If coach likes you, then you get to get in the game, period. Just straight up. I mean, there's no other way to explain it, you know. Here's how I say it, and I'm a high school coach. There's kids on the team, and not my team, on the football team. If the running back, the star running back, I remember in high school, our star, when I was coaching, I was teaching actually. Our high school team was really good at football. The star running back got caught having sex with the girl in the locker room, and the girl got suspended.
Hey, that girl needs to stay out of the locker room. I mean,
Oh, he didn't get in trouble. He didn't get in trouble. She got suspended for having sex with him in the locker room because he was the victim.
She's lucky he didn't press charges.
I mean, it just, she probably took one for the team. I mean, that's probably the worst way to put it. But
yeah,
she to me, I think she said, I'll take the rap. But it's just your value. I mean, and nobody can deny it because it's not an even playing field. It's a dog-eat-dog world, obviously.
Well, let me give a couple other examples. Recently, Dana White told the media that Sean Shelby and McMaynard were so upset that he signed Jake Hadley that they stormed out of the UFC Apex Center. So Jake Hadley
it went against Jake everything. Hadley. I mean, the guy missed weight. I mean, how do you sign a guy that misses weight? You know,
so Jake Hadley fights for Cage Warriors.
Yeah.
Wins the title, misses weight in his first title defense, and they sign him, and I've watched video on him. Doesn't really move the needle too much.
I mean, he's also from another country. So,
yeah, he's from Europe.
So, I mean, I don't want to cry with spilled milk, but I'll tell you what happened to me. I don't even know how to recover from it mentally. I always look back and wonder what if and like how. Like, I know why, but it's hard to get over. It is.
You're saying you know why. Can you elaborate that a little bit more?
It was Joe Silva, 100%. I mean, it wasn't any other reason.
What do you think you did to make him? I know going around his back and talking to Dana, which wasn't going around his back. I mean, but even before that, he seemed to not like you. I mean, making you fight 8 times to get. I mean, what do you think?
He didn't like me because from the Ultimate Fighter, me saying, "Hey." It was just originally him saying, "Hey, you'll never get in the UFC." He was dead serious. And he was like, "Man, you got beat on the Ultimate Fighter." Like, he was like, man, he was dogging me out. I was like,
he beat the guy who won it. I mean, it was by the guy who won it.
I think I was the only guy that got cut from that show that made it back on. Nobody else made it back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nobody. Okay. Not anybody. Well, now, guys stayed like Matt Brown, CB Dolloway. There's a couple guys that stuck around. Look at Matt Brown. He's still fighting to this day.
I know.
Nobody did what I, nobody went on the regional circuit
and came back.
Like, okay. I proved him wrong.
He don't like that. Right.
All those guys that got beat Ultimate Fighter never really amounted to much. They didn't do much. No offense to those guys. I was the only one that came back and wrecked shop. And he's like, oh, man, this dude proved me wrong.
All right, so Gerald, let's come full circle here. Let's just say you're Jake Hadley. You've got the two guys that get to pick who you fight so mad at Dana White. They're so beside themselves that they can't stand to be in the same building as him because they signed him.
I would say this. I don't think anybody has a Joe Silva mentality. And all respect to Joe, man. There's a lot of stories about him, and he pissed off a lot of people. You know, I don't know why he's not there. Mick Maynard's amazing. Sean Shelby, super nice. I feel like I was so close to getting back in the UFC, and Mick's like, man, it ain't going to happen. And this is when COVID hit. I don't think they're going to take the same route. I think Mick or Sean handles the lightweights. I don't know. I think they're going to say, all right, you want this guy? Let's put him to the test and give him a chance to make or break it. And I like that. I like that better than a lose-lose situation, you know? So, I mean, and Chris, you know it, man. I'd rather fight a Chris Lieben before I fight Amistad Makhmudov that nobody knows, that's a badass. Nobody cares. If I knock that guy out, you ain't going to remember him. But if I knock out, you know, Dan Hardy, it's like, yay, knock out Dan Hardy. That's the part that people don't understand, man. It's really about who you fight, man. It makes a big difference. You have to earn the right to fight someone with a name because everybody's trying to protect their ranking and their resume. And they're like, dude, you're unranked. I'm ranked 5. Why am I going to fight you? I have nothing. It's a lose-lose. For the guy that's ranked number 5, why would you fight? What's the one guy named with the green hair? Really cool. Smokes a lot. He's like 145. I like him a lot. Sean O'Malley. Why would you fight Sean O'Malley if you're top 5? Why? It's a lose-lose situation. If you beat him, so what? If you knock him out, you're supposed to. That's what the public thinks. So, you know, I was in a lose-lose situation, man.
Well, I mean, here.
Not only that, but the pressure, man. The pressure when you have a fight and you're supposed to win.
You can't even win.
You have to win and win impressively. If you go out there and win a split decision, you are not that good. You're falling apart. Nope. You suck. That pressure is real, man. When you got that pressure on you, I love being the underdog. There's no pressure, man. I mean, it is so much better to go out there.
In a sport where anything can happen. One punch, man. One punch, one knee, one submission. I mean, and you want me to go out here and swing for the fences and be impressive and be entertaining? The risk is not worth the reward. You got to go home safe, and you get half your money. I'm going to tell you right now, MMA would be so much better if it was flat pay.
Full force. Yeah.
Flat pay. I mean, I wouldn't have 10 of the fights. Honestly, I'd be 5-5. I wouldn't give a shit. If you gave me all my money – I mean, I'd be happy, but when you tell me I'm going home, with my first fight in the UFC was 6-6. So even with
big
the
time,
loss,
man, you made a lot of
I
money.
I would have went home with $6,000. I was already negative a couple hundred in the bank. Like, you know, and 20 to 30% of your purse is already gone, the payouts. I mean, people don't understand. If you go 0-3 in UFC, that's less than $40,000 a year. Not counting what you got to pay out. I mean, you just can't live off of it. So
was that Falco fight? Was that a no contest on your record, or was it a loss?
Nope. And here, let me. I'm glad you said that. The Michigan Athletic Commission does not drug test for MMA. When he failed the drug test, it was the UFC's drug test, and Tyson Griffin failed for marijuana. The UFC's private drug test. So there was no real suspension. The only suspension you could get was from the UFC, not the Athletic Commission. So a lot of people don't know that.
So both fighters get cut, and he still takes a loss when a guy clearly cheated.
Well, he got cut. They had to find a way to cut him, if that makes any sense. And they pulled up some old video of him fighting at a gas station. He was going to be gone. Once he failed that drug test, he was never going to fight in the UFC again. They were really pissed off about him failing that drug test. Not only failing a drug test, but not using human pee. That's just ridiculous. I mean, you really try to beat the system. So, yeah, he was in big trouble.
He's not even using human pee. You know, it had to be like the wrong temperature, too. It was probably like 58.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't help when your coach. You're dead. Doesn't help when your coach is trying to help you pee. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah, well,
they're really close.
In terms of precedence, actually, former UFC champion Kevin Randleman was accused of using pee from a cadaver.
I mean, I guess at least
it's human.
Chris, you've heard some stories. We've heard them all. We know who's users and who got caught. And I've heard of fake penises. I've heard it all. And honestly, man, I've lost to a few guys that have failed drug tests. And if that's what works, then great. I don't like it. I don't think it's fair. But honestly, in the end of the day, when I'm 50 years old, I'm going to feel good. I'm going to look good. And the guys that cheat, they're going to feel like straight horse shit because they overuse their bodies and they'll be limping. And, you know, everybody I know that use heavily, they're not doing good right now physically. They're not.
Exactly. That's my thing. I'm like, man, I'm 47 right now. I feel great. I don't even care if people cheat. I really don't. If you want to take steroids, whatever, because I plan on living a long time, and I'm gonna. This isn't the apex of my life, being on those. You know, that's not the high point.
I just don't want somebody to cheat and injure somebody. I mean,
yeah,
That's when I get mad. I mean, I've lost to plenty of cheaters, but I'll take it. You know, I will say this. Although my UFC career didn't go the way it went, or who knows what would have happened. The way my life played out, man, I can't even ask for nothing different. My wife is amazing. I have some amazing kids after that. And I'm a weird person. I feel like everything you do in life plays. If you turn left, turn right. And I feel like even though I got cut, the only thing that helps me not get over it, the only thing that helps me push through all that crap is it made me a better coach for sure. You know, but also just the way my life played out now, I'm happy, man. I got an amazing wife. My kids are crazy as hell. We got 8 kids total. I use that in my comedy all the time. I really don't even have to write jokes, man. I go on that stage and I literally talk about my life. Good night, baby. Hey, say hi. Hey, look at this girl. 5 times.
Hey, honey, champion, how you bro. Doing?
Beautiful.
Hey. Look at that face. Did that look like a 5-time state champion?
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me see them ears.
Hey, but I love the way my life played out. And I'll tell you right now, if I stayed in UFC, Chris, I don't think I'd really be happy right now.
Yeah.
I know. I'm at peace with the way my life played out.
So Gerald,
let me say something. That's tough right there. But I remember, man, like I was talking about everything in my life was built up for me winning the Ultimate Fighter, getting the title shot against AP, or winning the money. It didn't happen, man, and it killed me for a while. And I was waking up at 3 a.m, couldn't get back to bed. And just I couldn't think of anything else. But you know what? Eventually, I decided, man, I'm gonna change the way I do stuff. I gotta win this money. What it really did for me. Had I won that fight, would I have figured out that I can do everything no matter what? Like, I have a mentality now, like, I'm gonna make this work no matter what happens. So would that have happened if I hadn't lost that split decision? Would I have changed the way I did stuff, or would I just continue to make excuses for things in my life now? Like, I promise you, everything that happens in my life that goes wrong, it's my fault. It ain't nobody else's fault. I promise you, it's my fault. I make a lot of mistakes. But I didn't have that mentality before. I thought that, oh, this is bullshit. This is this person's fault. Man, that's me. So looking back, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I didn't think of it at the time. Do you see things like that? Do you see the positive side of this and that makes you happy now? Or like you said, what if you had one or the hadn't cut you and now you're not as happy as you are now? Do you look at it like that?
I know that if I stayed in the UFC, I wouldn't be where I am today. I mean, with the woman I have on my side, with the kids that I have, and I don't know what would have happened as far as, I mean, I was in a really bad, a lot of people don't know I was married that year and it wasn't good. It didn't last long, right? You know? It was kind of an ultimatum. It was a lot going on that year, man. And I wasn't really happy in my personal life when I was in the UFC. I mean, I used to just really hate being home sometimes, you know? Now, nothing against my kid's mom. We're good friends now. We get along great. But that relationship just to me at the time was toxic mentally and physically. It was just draining me. Mm. And I was either training or on a video game. You know what I'm saying? But I was not happy at home.
Hide it.
Yeah. You know, and who knows what would happen if I had a 10-year UFC career. I mean, we definitely wouldn't have split up. So soon after UFC, you know, I filed for a divorce and, you know, my life played out really well. I mean, we'll talk about more of my career, which is actually pretty cool. I'll tie into that. My life after the UFC played into where I'm at now.
So, one of the questions that I can't believe, like, and we're going to get to some of the other fights there, but I'll just wrap it up real fast like this. You did enough to get back to the UFC resume wise after you got cut the first time, but they ruled you out. They had already ruled you out. Like, yeah, you're not good enough. Don't call back. He hung up on you. Like, what did you do to, like, how does that feel? What did you do to deserve that? You know?
Yeah, whose cereal did you pee in?
And then you mentioned, and I'm sorry, but keep going, but then you mentioned the relationship. But me as a matchmaker, you come back to me 3 years later and say, look, I'm clean in my personal life. I'm not carrying the same baggage. I'm willing to give a fighter another shot. You know, I did.
Well, I didn't do enough physically to get back in the UFC. I lost my first fight after that. I lost to a guy, James Head, controversial split decision. I definitely won the first and the third rounds 100%. He won the second round. But they wanted him in the UFC really bad, so they gave him the decision, and he went on to the UFC. I think he went like 2-2. Anyway, and then I won. I mean, my career was a roller coaster after that. I wasn't training the same. I was still training hard. It just wasn't the same, Chris. It's hard to wake up and train for $2,000. I mean, I'm sorry. It just was.
I get it. Motivation is everything, man.
So you know, where does your relationship with Daniel Cormier come in?
Oh, so a lot of people don't know DC. DC started training with me maybe 2009. I don't remember what year it was. He started training with me while I was on the local circuit after the Ultimate Fighter. And we trained him for his first fight. And we had nobody in the gym that was his size. And I knew he was going to go somewhere. And after we trained him for his first fight, he went to AKA. He was at AKA for a little bit. And I called him. He was in town for the Branch fight. So we worked out. He helped me get ready for David Branch for like a day or two. But I've been knowing DC since we were in college. I've been knowing Daniel Cormier for over 20 years. You know, we've been friends for a long time. And yeah, he's a good dude. So we're still friends to this day. When I went to California like 2 years ago, I went and hung out with him, and he's still the same dude. So DC's a good boy, good guy.
Yeah, he's coaching high school wrestling as well, much like yourself.
Yeah. I mean, he's like probably one of the goats of MMA as far as heavyweights. And if I call him today, he'll answer the phone. I could pull up on his house right now. If he comes in town, he'll come to my gym. I mean, he's just the same old dude. So.
It's interesting. Okay.
So take us through this here. So, Mike, where are we next? Are
you gonna Miguel, you know what?
Well, I want to pick up where he got on to. After UFC, it was just rocky. I won some. I'll tell you the best fight I won. And Chris Lytle, you know about this guy. I was absolutely – now, I have a different type of fear. I'm the type of person that the more pressure I have, the better I perform. I was absolutely afraid to fight Jorge Santiago, George Santiago.
Oh, yeah.
I had watched that guy win 170 and 185 and dream. I watched him knock people out. And then I went to Florida to train with Rashad, and I sparred with
Santiago.
And he beat the shit out of me. I mean, really? He leg kicked me to death. I mean, he was just moving real slow, just pop, pop, pop. I was like, God, this dude is a Frankenstein. I mean, we were doing light sparring, and he was just, I remember him kicking me in my leg, and I'm like, oh my God. So they called me like a month later, like, hey, this is the World Series of Fighting. They're like, we got a fight for you. I'm like, all right. They're like, Santiago. I said, nah, I just trained with the guy. I don't think he'll fight me. They was like, he took the fight. I was like, I bet he did. He beat my ass in sparring. I trained my footwork so hard for that fight. And when I tell you guys, I was breakdancing in that fight. I just did not. So other than the George Santiago fight, I didn't really do anything that impressive to get back in the UFC. But my whole goal in life, Chris, from 2010 until 2016, was it 16, 2016 when we met? Yes. Was to get back in the UFC. Every fight and then every time I lost, I go, oh, I'll never get back in. You know that feeling?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I lost. I'm never getting back in. I need 10 more wins, you know?
Yeah.
And even by then, you know, I think McMahon was changing over and Joe Sibyl was coming out. It was all the way up. I retired. I broke my hand three times, y'all. I broke my hand three times. I broke my hand in 2011, 2013, and 2015. I broke my hand three times.
Every 2 years, geez.
Yes, and I was like, oh, my God. I told my coach, my last fight was Santiago. I broke my hand fighting Santiago, and that was the third time I broke my hand, and I made some good money in the World Series of Fighting. And that was back when they were really doing bad. They didn't give me a fight for like a year. And I said, I'm done. I retired. And that was maybe 2015 when I retired. Anyway, long story short, and I'm jumping ahead in the career because there's nothing really exciting in between this.
No. We're good.
I'm on Twitter.
Top five after this, and we'll wrap up. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, I don't want you knocking it too much, too, because you after the James Head loss, where you dropped two in a row, you did go 8-1, including the Santiago win. That's enough to get people back to the UFC in many cases. You can pull it apart, but
I know my losses. I don't know my wins that well. I know I lost to James Head. And I lost to what's that little guy's name?
Josh Berkman.
Josh Berkman was a lot of power, man. Guy, good footwork, a lot of power. He caught me pretty good in the fight. I know I lost to those two guys, but I'm done fighting. I'm like, I'm not ever fighting again. I go back to a regular life. I get certified in teaching. I'm back to my regular life. And I'm on Twitter, Chris. And I swear to God, I'm always looking at my ads because I'm talking noise. And a guy named Aaron Cobb goes, hey, I heard you're looking for a fight. And, you know, I'm like, I looked the guy up. I'm like, this dude really fight. He's 6-3. I said, I'm not really looking for a fight. Like, are you serious? And he was like, yeah, I heard you're looking for a fight. Let's make it happen. And I'm like, this cannot be happening right now. This is how the viral slam happened. I got the screenshots. And he's like, I heard you're looking for a fight. I want to fight you. Something, something, something. I'm like, this can't be real. We're having this conversation on Twitter. So I text Legacy, who's coming in town in December. I say, hey, this guy wants to fight me. He's 6-3. I don't know what my record is. I want to make this happen. And they're like, all right. And like 2 days later, we're signing a contract.
Wow, that's crazy. So when was this?
This was in 2016. I just met my wife. We got married 90 days after we met. She's right here.
Oh, wow.
Hey. So me and her, we met at a friend's funeral. A mutual friend passed away named Dylan. That's who we named our daughter after. We got married 90 days later. I had no intentions on fighting. We're just hanging out. We opened a gym. I mean, things are just, life is good. I got a job running the gym. And I said, babe, can I fight? She goes, all right. That's not a conversation with Chris. I was like, all right. I was like, all right. So wow. I signed a contract, bro. Legacy. The money wasn't good, but I sold over 15 grand in tickets. I think I sold like $10,000 worth of tickets in like 2 days, literally.
Nice.
There was a line out of my gym to get tickets. Like, we sold.
Oh, my God, dude. That's nuts.
So I sell all. Mind you, I haven't fought in years. Did I fight after Santiago? I don't remember. I haven't fought in a long time. No, I didn't. I hadn't fought since Santiago fight. And I'm like, I'm coming out of retirement. It blows up. It's at the Hard Rock in Tulsa. The event completely sells out. And first he goes 170. I go, all right, I'll do 70. Then a week before the fight, 180. I said, I'll do 180. Then the day before weigh-ins, he goes, hey, man, I can't make 180. Can't do 185. I'm like, all right, I'll do 185, whatever. So I'm there. I'm there. I can't tell the whole story because I'll probably get suspended for life because I'm there the day of weigh-ins and they call me and they go, Gerald, we got a problem. I said, what? They said, he's 220.
What?
220, Chris. Chris, I just got through cutting weight. I'm 185. I'm sitting on the couch. I'm mad as hell. I go downstairs. I check my weight and I'm like, bro, you got to be kidding me. They're like, bro, he's 220. There was like,
you sold too many tickets.
They like, can you wait? They say, can you weigh 206 tomorrow? I said, bro, I don't know if that's physically possible for me to drink 9,000 gallons of water, but.
Yeah, 20 pounds. I gained 20 pounds.
But I got a couple rolls of quarters.
I weigh 206.1 the next day. We weigh in the day of the fight. He comes in. He says he's 218. He comes in 226 pounds. Now,
so you're saying is he had a really good camp?
This is Aaron Cobb, by the way, everybody.
Yeah, and he has some mental things going on. He was, you know, a war veteran, and I mean, like, he's a really good guy. I talked to him a couple times.
Well, so, Chris Whedon,
I'm not liking him already.
He pretty much let himself. I saw him now; he looks really good, but he let himself go. He's all fat and stuff, and I mean, and this may sound crazy, and Chris always asks you to co-sign. The only reason I took the fight and him being 224 pounds is because he was short. He was probably, and when I say short, for 220 pounds, he was short. He's probably 5'9". And a 6'5", 224 pounds is a lot different.
Yo, than
5'10". I'm 5'11". I'm like, my coach was like, okay, if he's short, we'll do it. But if he's tall, I'm not fighting no big ass.
Yeah. Big leverage, so all that. Nah. Yeah, if he's 5'9", he's either extremely muscular or he's doughy. Either way, exactly. I'll take it.
So,
6'5", 220, you basically fight Deontay Wilder, God.
Yeah, exactly. So he's really muscular now, but back then he had some stuff going on. Anyway, shows up at 224. I weigh in at heavyweight. 206 is the limit. Because you can't weigh in at under 206.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fight at heavyweight.
Wow.
So I make the weight, go backstage. He comes back, y'all. Listen to me. I'm warming up and I'm dead serious. I'm hitting the pad. Da, 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 da. He comes backstage with a Coca-Cola and a big ass tub of fries.
Bro.
And my coach looks over and goes, at him? I said, yeah, he had a football jersey on. He said, Gerald, he's either crazy as hell or he's playing a trick on you. You know what I mean? Like, he's yes. showing up with this stuff, pretending like he out of shape. He said,
hopefully nah. not the latter.
Yeah.
Hey, my coach said, nope. He said, no, I don't trust him. He said, he's the craziest hell, or he trying to play mind games with you. You know, coming back there like I'm fat and then come out there and kick my ass.
And then not eating it and hide and go and train real hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And I swear somebody told me this. Somebody from his gym was like, his last words when he left the gym was, I'm not going to get slammed. Like, he put on all that weight. Like, he can't pick me up if I'm 224 pounds.
Yeah, I missed weight by 35 pounds.
170.
Literally the worst slam I've ever put on any human being. And
really?
Even a dummy. I do slams on dummies all the time. I've never slammed somebody that hard. It was amazing. It was an amazing night. I remember slamming him and just, I felt the wind of the breath of the audience. When they said, you just feel it. It was like a through the crowd. I'm not kidding you. It's the weirdest. It happened to me two times in my career. When I slammed Devin Branch, I felt the wind of the people. And then when I slammed Aaron Cobb. And to this day, I get tagged in that video. And like it happened yesterday. I got people inboxing me. Man, you awesome, man. When's your next fight? I'm like, bro, that was in 2016. Like,
yeah, at home with the kids. Yeah, that's my next fight.
I went on this crazy story, but it ties into what you guys were asking. That was my big shot to get back in the UFC. I was in. Mick Maynard was just left. I'm like, ooh, I'm in the UFC. I want to go straight to the UFC.
Yeah.
And the Ultimate Fighter trials are going on at the same time. So I personally knew that getting back in the UFC wasn't enough. I'd have got one or two fights. If I lost, I sucked. The Ultimate Fighter had a $250,000 prize, and it was called the comeback season. So every middleweight, it was at middleweight, and I was like, this is perfect timing, bro. You know, I slammed, and I was in. I mean, I went to the interview, they're like, yeah, you know you're in, right? Like, you just slammed this guy to death in Legacy, and that's when Legacy was a feeder to the UFC.
Yeah.
So I personally felt like, why go straight to the UFC? I didn't really have an option to go straight to it. But I knew the Ultimate Fighter was great. You win Ultimate Fighter, you win $250,000. My toughest fight was going to be Jesse, what's his name? Jesse?
The guy who got kicked off for...
Yes.
JT Taylor.
Taylor.
Jesse was an amazing matchup for me. No offense to Jesse, but I bust his ass. I mean, Jesse was perfect. Because his biggest strength was my biggest strength. And I get on the show, I'm all in. I signed a contract. I got my flights. I got my videos made. I documented all my training. They sent us home with cameras to document our training. I mean, it in my last video that night, I was talking about, hey, I'm flying out tomorrow. I want to get my feet wet before I go. And you can't take your trainers to the Ultimate Fighter. You know what I mean? You got to go there. And we talked about how terrible the training is on the show. And I'm in a cage by myself, shadow boxing. I make a quick turn and it sounded like somebody shot me in the back of my leg and I tore my Achilles tendon.
I remember you telling me that.
Jesus.
I tore it the day before I flew out. It was a Thursday night. I was flying out Friday. They started filming on Saturday. And I called, something like that. I called the guy that morning. I said, hey, man, I think it was Gary DeFranco. And I said, hey, I'm not going to make it. And he said, you sure you can't just fly out here? I said, Gary, I tore my Achilles tendon.
Man, you better go get that duty injury. You got
to
go.
Yeah, I know. And I'll trust me, I wanted to fly out there to be on TV for 2 days and say I twisted my ankle. But I just didn't want to. I really made
you want to take someone else's spot.
No, I damn near was going to fly out there and get my little 3 days of airtime. Like that, your twisted ankle looked kind of weird, bro. So I did that so someone else would have the opportunity to go.
That's good.
And I just knew it wasn't worth flying out there and pissing them off even more. By I knew I tore my Achilles. I knew it. And I had surgery not long after that. Shouldn't have fought so soon. I fought 6 months after I tore my Achilles. And my doctor said he's never in life seen someone compete as fast as I fought. I had Achilles surgery in February and I fought in August. That's unheard of. So, yeah. I mean, I was barely running at that time, but I needed the money, honestly.
Yeah, no. So, you know, we're kind of trying out a new segment here. Would you mind giving us your top five all-time fighters, you know, before we wrap up?
Like that I've ever fought?
No, just period. No.
I was like, I don't know, hell. Oh, man, that's hard. Man, I'm old school, bro. I mean, you got to go with Royce Gracie. I mean, it's just obviously Royce Gracie can't beat Brock Lesnar, but that's two different generations. You know what I'm saying? Royce Gracie, to me, he changed the game. When he beat Ken Shamrock, he was this little skinny dude in a karate suit who looked like he got bullied in high school. You know, and he chokes out Shamrock. You know what I'm saying? So definitely Royce Gracie. You got to – Anderson Silva, you got to say Anderson Silva. The guy came in. GSP is another one that definitely changed the game. And here's one that'll surprise a lot of people that people don't understand. I love Mighty Mouse, man. I don't think the little guy gets enough credit. That, you know, it's not any easier being small fighting. It's actually harder. You know, it's a lot harder. Those guys move a lot. You know what I mean? And for what he did with 10 titles or something like that.
I always tell people, man, like the bigger the weight class, the worse the fighter. Heavyweights aren't good fighters, man. I mean, you can say whatever, they hit hard, but I mean, they're not as skilled. The lighter you get, the more skill is involved, man, in my opinion.
That's every sport. They got way more work.
I mean, dude, those 135 pounders, so much move. I mean, I get tired watching them. You know what I mean? You know, 55s, tired. I mean, the higher you get, I think that. It's more impressive because they're stronger and bigger, but man, they're not as good of, they're not all around fighters like the lighter guys. Lighter guys are just unbelievable. You're right there.
Now, I wouldn't put this guy on my, what do you call it? What do you call that with a president's?
Mount Rushmore.
I wouldn't put this guy on my Mount Rushmore coaches, but one of my all time favorite fighters, period, is Robbie Lawler. Just period. Yeah. I love Great. Robbie Lawler, man. I love the way he is the definition of a fighter. He's a great person out of the cage. I mean, the dude, I mean, I don't know what else you can ask for. I mean, he brings it every time. I mean, he is one of my favorite fighters of all time. So,
absolutely. Good list. Good list.
So that's it, brother.
Hey, man, I really appreciate your time. And that's just, brother, I can't get even my heartache right now from hearing the thing. You had to go, man, it's messed up. I mean, I remember you being there, and I remember, like I said, watching you fight someone. I never really knew exactly what happened, but it's messed up, and it just doesn't make any sense to me, man. I want to know. I want to do Joe Silva next and try and ask him about this. You know what I mean?
Maybe that'll be our second trip, Chris. Yeah, we'll go from the manager house to Joe Silva.
Mike, you said you like to watch people in the background. Watch my fight with David Branch, and as soon as I slam you, look in the background, and Joe Silva,
he jumps.
No.
Yeah.
And I'm Nuh-uh. Like this.
Yeah.
I'm about to hammer fist him, and Joe goes, no. And I'm like, okay. I mean, I didn't hear Joe, but I saw David Branch's eyes roll, and I was like, oh. I was like, okay, I ain't got to hit him.
Dude, that was a great.
Joe's in the background like this, his hands up.
That's Joe Rogan even commented saying you did the right thing by, like, he knew he was out. Yeah. He didn't put an extra punch on him. And I think that kind of shows who you are as a fighter. Like, you're a nice guy. A lot of fighters would have took that opportunity.
Maybe I wouldn't have got cut. I don't know. Hey, hey, David told me, I'm sorry, I won't take too much time. David Branch told me, we were at McDonald's after that fight. And he goes, hey, man, I would have hit your ass after I knocked you out. That's what he told me. He told me that. He's like, I'd
funny,
I'd
man. That's kind of funny. Yeah, I love it.
Because I held back. And he's like, I'd hit you. I would have hit you. Yeah, anyway, I appreciate you guys, man.
I do. I'm grateful to you. I know, Mike, and we're trying to wrap up, but there's one name and one fight. You took a trip to Japan and fought in dreams against Nakamura. Now, Nakamura was a big name. He fought.
Oh my goodness.
He came over to the UFC, it went bad because he was smaller and he fought at 205. But, like, you had him at a nice time. You beat him over there. And again, they didn't have you back. Like, what? Well, there's got to be a story.
That was probably one of the hardest fights of my career. He was so big. He was strong. Okay, let me tell you about this Nakamura fight. Please look at this dude's resume. Mind you, he was probably like 18 and 13. All 13 of his losses were like UFC and Pride champions. Listen, I'm talking about
Leona Machida,
Rampage Jackson, Leona Machida, Wanderlei. Bro, he went to decision with Wanderlei Silva. Decision. So I'm like, I'm not about to knock this dude out. Like,
no.
No, he went to decision with Wanderlei Silva. Like, that fight was so hard, but I got paid really good. I got an opportunity to go to Japan. I had a great time. That was fun. But it was a – oh, my God. He was he rung me, too, really good in that fight. He caught me, but he didn't know it.
Nakamura has wins over Igor Vachanchin, Murilo Bustamante, Yuki Kondo, Kevin Randleman.
Yeah, he beat Kevin Randleman. Look at his losses, though. He didn't lose to nobody normal like me. Like everybody.
Josh Barnett. He lost to Josh Barnett.
Wow. Hey, one question. When you went to Japan, did you go to Roppongi afterwards?
I don't even know. What's that?
That's the bar district where everybody hangs out. The bars afterwards.
I am the lamest fighter ever. When I slammed David Branch and I got a bonus, I went out for 50 seconds. I'm not exaggerating. I went to the club. I said, yep, I'm going to bed. I went to bed like 11 o'clock that night. I don't party, man. I don't go out. I think I partied enough in college. I was in a fraternity house.
There you go.
And that kept me out of a lot of trouble. No street fights. No, I didn't roll with a crew. It was me, my daddy, my brother, my mom. When I went to Japan, I fought. I went to McDonald's and I went to bed. I didn't go to no clubs or nothing.
You talk about like those guys. Like that's when I used to go to Japan and fight a lot. And everybody, I mean, all they put a lot of pride in the Japanese guys fighting the toughest guys in the world. They all had like not great records because of that. But everybody they fought was tough, man. I mean, there was
nothing but monsters, man. Yeah, that Nakamura dude. I looked at his record. I'm like, okay, he's kind of a tough guy. And I looked at who he lost to. I'm like, man, damn, Wanderlei Silva. Like, bro, three rounds with Wanderlei is hard. Like,
and that was a yoked up, juiced up Wanderlei too.
Yes.
Yes. No rules. No rules, Wanderlei Silva.
I'm like, what am I going to do to this? I literally just used my speed on him. I was really quick. I just lit him up, man. I was tearing Nakamura up. He caught me with an overhand right that blacked me out for about 5 seconds, but I stood my ground and pretended like I wasn't hurt. But he threw me, but I got up and I tried to slam him and he grabbed the ropes. And Chris, you know in Japan, they don't boo. They boo him because that's disrespectful in martial arts. When I picked him up to slam him, he grabbed the ropes, and I'm literally pulling him off the ropes, and they booed. And if you get booed in Japan, that is bad.
Yeah, that's real bad, man.
Check this out. He won a split decision, and you know what that means on the road. He had to kill the guy, you know? I mean, you know.
Yeah, he didn't win one round. He didn't win one. He probably landed like three strikes the whole fight. I tore him up. I mean, I was tagging him.
Dreams never call you again?
That was the time when it was kind of going under. That the tsunami just hit. Dream wasn't, they weren't really picking up at the time. When that happened. So it wasn't nothing personal. They were cool as hell though. I had a good time.
Such a major win that, you know, that's a blip on the radar. You went 8-1 and you kind of forgot about it, but that really is again something that
I could have went 75 and won. The only thing that got me back in the UFC was that slam over that guy. I will say this, I do wish that I stuck with the World Series of Fighting at the time. They were kind of up and down. Look at them now. They're the PFL, you know. And
paying $1 million and stuff.
Yeah, $1 million tournament. I mean, it would have been great to be a part of that. I was in and out of comments. I think I talked to Ray Safo before the Ultimate Fight. I don't remember. Was it after the Ultimate Fight?
You know, Miguel is a matchmaker, and I know where Gerald's got his wife telling him he's got to go to bed. Miguel, as a former matchmaker at a high level, coaches and managers continuously just try to get that matchmaker into a gray area, try to flip them. And I mean, Miguel, you experienced it with coaches sending you TVs when you were in charge of Bodog. And I think that's the key. I think the best managers in MMA have got blackmail on the matchmakers.
I almost signed with Ali. He's a great guy. I had a chance to get back in the PFL, and I talked to Ray Safo. He gave me a great offer, and I said, Mr. Safo, with all due respect, I cannot make 170 again. And he's like, damn. He's like, well, I was like, I have to walk away from this opportunity. And that was when the PFL first started, but there's no way. I was getting too old. I think I was 37, and I just 170 was hard. It was after the Achilles tear. You know, I had two wins, and I said, Mr. Safo, I just can't make 70. And he's like, man, we got one spot open. And yeah, I couldn't, because you had to make it a lot. You make like five times that year. And that was pretty much the end of my career after that. I fought in Bellator. That didn't go great. My last win was over Seth Brzezinski, which was a really hard fight. Chris, you know about Seth.
Yeah.
Seth's a monster, but Seth's another matchup that was really good for me. He's a grinder.
True Fickett protege.
Yeah. Yeah, he has wins over Matt Brown and that one guy, what's the black guy's name? Long, tall guy, really good. I can't think of his name. He's 170. Anyway, my last fight was over Seth Brzezinski in hopes of still trying to get in the UFC. And after talking to Mick Maynard, he's just like, it ain't happening, bro. Like,
that's messed up, dude.
I'm done. My career is far. Now, I would try bare knuckle. I know, Chris, I know you worked there or whatever, but I thought about it. I think it'd be fun as hell. As far as MMA, I don't want to get kicked in the leg no more and all that crap.
I tell you, the only reason I did bare knuckle, like, I watched my buddy Joe Riggs do it. I was like, what the hell's wrong with Joe? He was over in Europe. I was like, this is stupid. I figure it's going to be like a warehouse, bales of hay around him and people betting with smoking cigars. And I watched about two rounds and I turned to the guy next to me. I was like, hey man, how do I get in this? You know, I had the guy who's done this stuff, and I had a couple fights. I liked it. It was cool, man. But now I love it. Now I love watching it. It's very precise. If you ever want to do it, man, I got the hookup, dude. I'd commentate for him every time. I'm leaving tomorrow.
Well, I'll say this, since we're having this conversation, now it's funny. I talked to them I reached out to them on Twitter. You know, I always talk to them on Twitter.
Yeah.
I do have a manager now, and he reached out to him. He said they were talking, but I mean, we got some extra push. How cool would this be, Mike and Miguel, for this to grow into something? I would do bare knuckles straight up. So,
hey man, you know where we're at? We're at this weekend. We're going to be in Wichita, Kansas. If you want, I got you tickets.
What's Saturday?
Saturday night, baby, Wichita. All right, I don't know how far away it is for you.
Is it Friday or Saturday?
Saturday.
There.
Shoot me, Chris, when we get off here, shoot me a number. Chris, Mike,
I got
a number.
I'll hook you guys up.
We'll talk. I'll try to swing out that way, man. Be kind of cool.
Oh, sweet. Perfect. Yeah, I'll get you tickets, brother.
Are you on a road trip?
Chris, get him an autograph too. Get him an autograph.
Cool. All right, just real fast cleanup. I think Neil Magny's the guy you were referring to.
Neil Magny. Yes.
Neil Magny. Seth Brzezinski was a really hard win for me.
Oh, yeah.
And
up guy. Yeah.
Now, if I do come, Chris, I'm not going to climb in the ring and catch a two-piece like that dude did.
Not like you jump out there up against Hector. Don't jump out there against Hector.
Oh, man, that guy. Bam, bam. Oh,
hey, you don't Hector's walk up not the Hector right guy like to do that to, man. You know that.
Yeah, you don't walk up on Hector. Hey, I'll come out there, man, and if I can meet the right people, you never know. I might be on a
call. I'll get this hooked up before you know it, man. It'll be great.
Cool. Hey, shoot me that number, Chris, and then we'll make a road trip this weekend.
Gotcha.
Thank you very much, Gerald. Right. Thank you for all your time today, all your time the last week, and definitely an unsung hero, another unsung hero of the sport.
Yeah, hey, maybe we'll be talking about bare knuckle. Maybe we'll talk about bare knuckle next time I get on here.
Absolutely. I love it. Thanks, buddy.
You're good.
See y'all later.
Well, Gerald Harris, part two is in the books. And Mike, you know, this guy, well, I don't know why he doesn't have his own TV show or talk show or something.
No. Like, well, yeah. No. And you know, like if you had a party, he's one of the guys. Nope. Nope. He's in. He's got to come. He's got to come. But before we get there, betdsi.eu, promo code lights out, 50% of all deposits. Please get in there. It helps us out. But Gerald Harris, man, let me tell you something. Entertaining. And what did you think of his thoughts on Joe Silva?
You know, Joe's one of those guys that, like, you know, if you were there early on in the UFC, he had a fall from grace very early on. Because when Zuffa bought the UFC, he was de facto matchmaker and spokesperson until Dana got comfortable. And then they yanked him from the public view completely. The only real time you saw Joe Silva after that might be at the weigh-ins, and you might have heard Joe Rogan say, the best matchmaker in the world.
Okay, no, wait a minute. Wait.
Which was I disagree with.
Did you take that as a personal shot at the time?
You know, I'll tell you that there are a few other matchmakers in the area, and I communicated with Joe. So I do think that he had me in mind when he allowed that to go on in their presentation, or when that was thrown in there.
Do you think he instructed Joe to say that?
I don't know, because that's not quite that important, because what Gerald was doing was he was poo-pooing Joe. And I think what happened is in the early days, they yanked him from the public view. And he was able to operate in a closed office. And that makes you, hey, you make your own rules at that point. And you didn't have scrutiny.
Hold up.
You didn't have to be asked about the matchmaking or anything like that.
Let me set the table. Let me set the table here. Joe Silva lucked into a UFC matchmaker spot. At the time, you're matchmaking Bodog, and I think MFC, or not Bodog, Hook and Shoot, and Euphoria. Am I correct?
Yeah, you know. I mean, I was, put it this way, I was a matchmaker for Hook and Shoot, and I knew Joe Silva, and Joe Silva was a consultant.
He'd show up
for
to your events.
But we would bring him in. Joe Silva was a consultant for Bob Meyerowitz. So Joe Silva had roots that were deep with the UFC. When Art Davey left, he may have had some thought of being the matchmaker himself, but he was too young at that point, and Meyerowitz obviously went different direction and got Peretti. But Peretti wasn't going to stay with Zuffa.
No.
And it takes a strong person and someone who does know what they're doing to survive that, because Zuffa could very easily have looked at their own matchmaking. So if you're trying to get me to really shit on him, I can only do so philosophically.
I'm not trying to. I mean, I matchmake different.
But I think at some point, I don't even know if he overstepped his bounds, but he was a person that you could go up to as a press person and ask him about the matchmaking and what was going on. And that was taken away very early in the Zuffa reign, where we had no access to the matchmaker for years in an interview fashion. It's like, what were you thinking making that match or anything like that?
Well, Miguel, wait. So we just had Matt Serra on. He dumped all over him and was very direct when doing it. Chris and Matt relayed to each other what issues they had with Joe. Josh Neer, obviously, you know, had said that he wasn't real happy with Joe Silva. We've had Gerald Harris, obviously, on his podcast. There'll be more instances that we know. So you have to assume something probably bit him. Like, I'm not so sure he left on his own. He may have been asked to leave.
Well, he was there for a long, long time. And if you know the whole battle, what really happened when Zuffa came aboard, he lived in North Carolina or South Carolina or wherever, in one of the Carolinas is where he lived. And he resisted moving to Vegas for some time. And at some point when he moved to Vegas, there was another time where him and Dana, there was a disagreement of some type, and he left Vegas and went back to North Carolina. And then at some point they lured him back or whatever. But this was all behind the scenes. Not a lot of people know about that.
There was also a magazine article being written about him, and Dana pulled it.
Yeah, I think there's a situation there where Dana very astutely realized that you can only have one face.
Yes, maybe, true. I agree with that.
And, you know, I do think that they could definitely, if Joe was more of a public figure, it doesn't, you know, I think you can get away with having Joe as a public figure and Dana, but I think having Joe operate in secret and hiding in an office, yeah, some bad habits can form, like, hey, yeah, break his arm for me, you know? It's like, you, hey, as a matchmaker, you sometimes have that thought, I fucking hope, you know, or yeah, whatever, you know what I mean? And he's trying to, you know, at some point, he always had the excuse of, it's what Dana wants. It's what Dana wants. And who, nobody would take that guy on.
Oh, well, here.
Joe, just to survive that guy, you know, because Dana probably did three shows and Dana probably in his head was like, I could matchmake and just matchmake, you know what I mean? And get rid of Joe.
Well, but here, well,
Joe stayed on. So
Hold up. So Joe.
Joe's a complicated figure.
The Colorado event where it was all heavyweights at a high altitude. And everyone, like, I remember, like, looking at this card, like, a month out, talking to Lytle. Like, this is before the podcast even existed. And I'm like, Chris, this is going to be a bloodbath. They got all these heavyweights at that altitude. Like, we saw it. And Joe was responsible for that.
What card are you talking about?
Yeah, there was a card. I don't have it off the top of my head. But there was a UFC card in Colorado with, like, 8 heavyweight fights on it. And
now, Joe hasn't been there in several years, though. So if it was recent, I mean, I don't know.
But it was a while ago.
And when Joe left, again, it was kind of like, yeah, it was gone. He had replacements in place, and it moved on. And again, yeah, the other replacements, very, very little. You know, there was that talk of, like, they were mad that Dana signed a guy. But keep in mind, the only time you heard that, Zuf is gone. So now they feel a little more empowered with a different boss than Dana's daddies. That's what
it's interesting. It's interesting. You know, it's like Game of Thrones. Like,
it certainly is cutthroat. And that's the part of it that, you know, that I once too many lawyers get involved, I shut off. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, I'll tell you, the other part of it that plays in there is I was more of a public matchmaker. Like, I would do press conferences. Like, I was kind of like, people confuse me with Dana. Like, I'm not Dana in Bodog. Like, that's Calvin. And with Calvin, I'll put Calvin up as a personality and stuff against Dana, but Dana's the fight expert too over there, right? So and splitting that role, I know I can handle my role, but there's also a little bit of a conflict there. Like, you're taking away from him, or you got to kind of do what the boss wants and stuff. So, you know.
But well, hey, Miguel, this is a wrap up, and I think we're 10 minutes in. But ladies and gentlemen.
Look, we're going to
deep dive with us. You will be doing a deep dive, Miguel, whether you like it or not.
All right. Look, this is what we're going to do. If you're still listening right now, sign on to your little computers or your phones and send me an email. It's lightsoutpodcast@gmail.com. So it's lightsoutpodcast, one running sentence, @gmail.com. Include your address and we'll send you something. T-shirt or something like that. But if you're still listening now, you deserve something.
Well, no, fuck that. They got to hit share too. Let me tell you something, Miguel. If they're listening right now and you don't hit like and share, you're a scumbag. There you go. I said it, Miguel. I'm talking to our audience like that. Like,
we and excuse share. That if you make a BetDSI deposit and a couple other
things,
buy a whiskey and stuff. So
they'd be okay.
And anyway, we're shamelessly plugging at this point. So
we got to go.
We got to go. But thank you to Gerald Harris. And, you know, I love the guy. I want to have him back on, even though we've been through his career. I think we could keep talking for a million different hours. So thank you, Joe.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.